loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we discuss new reports of a massive interference campaign planned by an Israeli political firm into the U.S. 2016 election campaign. And then we continue our weekly series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, seen as a rising star in the Republican Party, abruptly resigned this morning. The news website Axios, which broke the story, said that the decision was Haley's and that the White House foreign policy team was, quote, shocked, unquote, when she offered the resignation a week ago. Next, Jair Bolsonaro, the far-right candidate in Brazil's presidential election, nearly scored an outright victory yesterday, falling just short of the 50% necessary to avoid a runoff. He will now face Workers' Party candidate Fernando Haddad, who finished with 29%. Then, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said yesterday that North Korea is ready to allow international inspectors into a key nuclear testing site, signaling a step forward in efforts to bring peace to the Korean Peninsula. Pompeo also said that another Trump-Kim summit was, quote, pretty close, unquote. And then the British online investigative group Bellingcat reported today that it had identified what it called a second Skripal poisoning suspect. The website says that Dr. Alexander Mishkin, a military doctor alleged to be in the pay of the GRU, the Russian military intelligence organization, had something to do with the Skripal poisoning. And while the circumstantial evidence is convincing that Mishkin was somewhere in the UK at the time that Sergei and Yulia Skripal were poisoned, there's no evidence that Mishkin had anything to do with it. And finally, renowned Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi went to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul over the weekend to fill out a form to register his upcoming marriage. He never came out of that consulate, and now Turkish officials who have received permission to enter the building to investigate are saying that he was murdered by Saudi officials and his body disposed of. And in other headlines, clashes broke out on the streets of Paris today as riot police unleashed tear gas on protesters and made multiple arrests. The demonstrations were being held to oppose French President Emmanuel Macron's economic reforms. Critics say the reforms will worsen living conditions for the country's working class and erode the protections won over decades of struggle by labor unions and other progressive movements. A report was released yesterday by the United Nations finding that by 2030, average global temperatures are likely to increase more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels and potentially up to 2 degrees Celsius. The 2015 Paris Climate Accords were focused on keeping the planet below that 2-degree mark, but this report shows that even the agreements made there may not be enough. Donald Trump took to Twitter today to criticize protesters who demonstrated against Brett Kavanaugh. Trump said, quote, the paid D.C. protesters are now ready to really, in capital letters, protest because they haven't gotten their checks. In other words, they weren't paid. Screamers in Congress and outside were far too obvious, less professional than anticipated by those paying or not paying the bills, unquote. Trump appears to have been referring to the conspiracy theory that opponents of his administration who take part in demonstrations are being paid by wealthy liberal donors. The climbing death toll in Indonesia has now passed 2,000. The earthquake and tsunamis that hit Sulawesi Island in Indonesia have caused weeks of destruction and death. On Thursday, authorities will hold prayer services in three different regions of Palu, the hardest hit area of the island, to mark the end of the search for bodies. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn back to the question of election interference in the 2016 presidential campaign. Indicted Trump campaign official Rick Gates apparently requested proposals in 2016 from an Israeli company to create fake online identities to use social media manipulation and to gather intelligence to help defeat Donald Trump's Republican primary challengers and later Hillary Clinton. The company is staffed by former Israeli intelligence officers, and while the New York Times says there is no evidence the Trump campaign actually engaged the company, an emissary of the United Arab Emirates Crown Prince, wrote the firm a check for $2 million after the election. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Max Blumenthal. Max is a journalist and best-selling author. His latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and the co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. Max Blumenthal, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Max, after all of the reports of Russian interference, so-called alleged, in the 2016 election, or last week, Mike Pence was saying China's already interfering in the 2018 elections. Here we have a case reported by the New York Times and now by other media, and I've seen that you are writing about it and tweeting about it as well, about the outrage from Rick Gates from the Trump administration to this Israeli company, again, designed to create fake online personalities with the intention of helping Donald Trump become president. Anyway, give us the broad outlines of what this proposal seemed to be.
Well, what we have here is one of a dizzying array of cases of Israeli direct interference in America's political system, and more specifically in the 2016 elections, and Israel's influence, direct influence on shaping the Trump administration's policy towards Iran. In this case, this information came out because Rick Gates, who was the partner of Paul Manafort, who was for a time the chief campaign aide and chief of staff to Donald Trump's campaign, was indicted along with Manafort. He dimed Manafort out in exchange for more favorable treatment from Robert Mueller, and gave Mueller pretty much as much information as he could give him about his interactions with foreign governments to influence the 2016 campaign. And Mueller just keeps coming back to Israeli interference, even though his job is supposed to be related to Russian interference. And it's because of the preponderance of examples of Israeli interference. In this case, Rick Gates was approached by someone named Joel Zemel, who is very well connected to the Israel lobby in the United States and runs a group called Psy Group, which is a private Israeli intelligence firm comprised of Israeli former intelligence officials that focuses on elections around the world and specifically interfering in them. And what they proposed to do, what they pitched to Rick Gates as a representative of the Trump campaign at an August 3rd, 2016 meeting at Trump Tower with Donald Trump Jr., was a $3 million persona management campaign that would have consisted of the creation of sock puppet accounts to influence Republican National Convention delegates against Ted Cruz, and to carry out an intelligence operation, an unspecified intelligence operation, presumably including gray propaganda, against Hillary Clinton and her inner circle. So what you have here is basically a massive plan to influence America's election through the kind of subterfuge that we have heard Russia is planning, but extends well beyond the kind of hacking that Russia is accused of. And again, it's just one more example of so many cases of Israeli interference. Just really quickly, I'd mentioned that August 3rd, 2016 meeting at Trump Tower. Joel Zemel was introduced to Rick Gates by George Nader, who was at the time representing the ruler of the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. Eric Prince was also there, the founder of Blackwater. George Nader is widely suspected in the Arab world of being a Mossad agent. He's been very close to the Israel lobby. And he himself has been involved with pro-Israel bigwigs like Ron Lauder over the years in trying to foster diplomacy with the Assad government of Syria, between Israel and Syria. So the connections just run so deep, and this should be considered a titanic scandal on top of several scandalous revelations about Israeli interference. But for some reason, I don't think it will wind up being a Democratic line of attack against Trump. I don't know why.
I think you're being facetious. I think you do know why.
Yeah, well, we all know why.
I think you have a suspicion.
Yeah, I have a slight suspicion.
Let's help the audience understand your suspicion.
Well, I mean, just look at Nikki Haley's retirement today from the Trump administration as UN ambassador. I mean, she was essentially a marionette for the Israel lobby and Netanyahu at the UN. And what is the response from the Democrats? Bob Menendez, who I think is the co-chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and is another tool of the Israel lobby, said there will be a leadership void in the Trump administration with Nikki Haley gone. I mean, they're lamenting Nikki Haley's resignation in the Democratic Party. Bob Menendez, I mean, this guy, when he was put on trial for corruption, he's one of the most corrupt people in Congress. All of his legal fees were paid for by AIPAC donors. So this is a bipartisan project of Israeli interference in U.S. elections and American politics. And it's not working out well for people who are concerned about a war against Iran.
Yeah, I hear you. I want to read from the New York Times article, Max, some of the specifics of what the proposal included. Now, the first proposal was to help Trump influence Republican delegates so that they wouldn't support Ted Cruz. And so what they were doing, well, I'm going to read the two paragraphs from the New York Times and then ask you to comment. The methodology towards Cruz and Cruz supporters is essentially the same that they were proposing against Clinton. So it's not different. As by way of sort of an example, let me read to you. The first document, dated April 2016, said that the company, quote, was asked to provide a proposal, close quote, for campaign intelligence and influence services, close quote. Citigroup promised that veteran intelligence officers, that I'm assuming from the Israeli Defense Forces, from Mossad, would use various methods to assess the leanings of roughly 5,000 delegates to the Republican nominating convention. After scouring social media accounts and all other available information to compile a dossier on the psychology of any persuadable delegate, more than 40 Psy Group employees would use, quote, authentic-looking, close quote, fake online identities to bombard up to 2,500 targets with specially tailored messages meant to win them over to Mr. Trump. The messages would describe Mr. Cruz's, quote, ulterior motives or hidden plans, close quote. Or they would appear to come from the former Cruz supporters or from influential individuals with the same background or ideology as a target. The barrage of messages would continue for months and include both online and offline approaches, even telephone calls. And the Citigroup also said it would obtain unique intel. What's that? By different means, including, quote, covert sources and, quote, tailored avatars. I mean, that's a pretty sophisticated operation.
Yeah, they proposed a $3 million operation. The group proposed to double its size, Citigroup, and to hire 50 people who would operate in a unique office. So they essentially proposed to create this gigantic troll farm slash covert intelligence operation to destroy Donald Trump's opponents. The deal came to nothing. However, we know that Cambridge Analytica and its British parent company, SCL Group, did do work for the Donald Trump campaign, as well as for the Brexit campaign, and they used many of these same techniques. Let's unpack this a little bit. I think that, you know, we joke all the time on this show about the, you know, the Russian troll farms, because a lot of it wasn't even targeting the election. 56% of the activities from the Internet Research Agency, which the Maddow and mainstream media have focused on obsessively, focused on reaching Facebook users after the election. And many of these accounts were just laughable that appeared on Facebook, these fake troll accounts that supposedly emanated from St. Petersburg. But here we have a clear outline of a plan to create a kind of troll farm to use persona management, sock puppet accounts, or tailored third-party messaging, in the words of Citigroup, to specifically target not just voters, but delegates at the Republican National Convention to manipulate them. The most interesting part to me, beyond that, is the promise of quote-unquote complementary intelligence activities from Citigroup to use against Hillary Clinton, including compiling dossiers on targets in Hillary Clinton's inner circle, including, quote-unquote, any actionable intelligence. Now, that sounds a lot like what the Israeli private intelligence firm Black Cube has been doing in the United States. Listeners of the show might be familiar with Black Cube targeting women who were accusers of Harvey Weinstein. This was revealed by Ronan Farrow in The New Yorker. that Weinstein had gone to this Israeli spy firm to basically send spies who are posing as businesswomen and feminists to meet with people like Rose McGowan and find out what they were going to accuse Harvey Weinstein of. Well, Black Cube was also active during the American presidential campaign in 2016 and before in compiling dossiers and digging up dirt on people in Obama's National Security Council, on his foreign policy team, specifically Ben Rhodes, who is his top national security aide and shepherded through the Iran deal to try to undermine the Iran deal. And we can assume that they were paid by someone like Sheldon Adelson, operating on behalf of Benjamin Netanyahu. In other words, an Israeli intelligence operation using subterfuge and covert intelligence against U.S. officials to undermine U.S. foreign policy in order to drive the case for war with Iran. And let me take that a little bit further. I mentioned Cambridge Analytica working for the Trump campaign. One of the key shareholders in Cambridge Analytica is named Vincent Cengiz, and he was the first client of Black Cube and was heavily involved with Black Cube. So the connections between all of these private intelligence agencies often go back. It's almost like they all go back to Israel. And I know that Robert Mueller is looking at this, but I have no idea how he's going to market these findings to a mainstream media that wants to keep the focus on Russia, even though there isn't much of a there.
Really, really interesting. And again, the article in the New York Times says that the Trump administration decided not to use this group. But then I want to read again, Mr. Nader, and who was then with the Trump campaign, and Mr. Zamal, the CEO, I believe, of this company, Citigroup, have given differing accounts over whether Mr. Zamal ultimately carried out the social media effort to help the Trump campaign and why Mr. Nader paid him $2 million after the election. I mean, why would that happen, Max? I mean, how could it? I mean, doesn't this indicate? I mean, oh, we have some extra millions of dollars, so we want to give them to you. I mean, this has to be for something, no?
Yeah. What we don't know what it's for, but there was a payment of $2 million. Eric Prince was in the room as well, and Eric Prince is heavily involved in shaping Trump's foreign policy. His family, the Prince Brookhisen family, are major Republican donors. They're behind Trump. Prince is pitching a plan to privatize the war in Afghanistan. So there are all of these kind of question marks around this. But one of the things we do know is that George Nader was representing the ruler of the United Arab Emirates. He's very closely tied to Israel. And Joel Zamel was representing an Israeli intelligence firm. And the Trump administration has unilaterally removed itself from the P5 plus one. You know, it's now what, P4 plus one or P5 Iran deal. And this is a direct result of Israeli and UAE influence on the Trump administration. It is pretty clear to me that Benjamin Netanyahu and his cutouts, as well as Mohammed bin Zayed, the emir of the United Arab Emirates, and his cutouts in Washington, who are working hand in glove, have shaped Trump's policy on Iran. A key lobbyist who is paid by the UAE to influence Trump, who presented Trump and the Trump administration with a special briefing on destabilizing Iran, which has become Trump's foreign policy, is Elliot Brody. And Elliot Brody also happens to be a top official in the Republican Jewish Committee, who's very closely connected to Benjamin Netanyahu. Then we have John Bolton. John Bolton's Secure America PAC was funded during the 2016 election by the head of the World Jewish Congress, Ron Lauder, who's a close personal confidant of Benjamin Netanyahu and is the billionaire heir of the Estee Lauder fortune. Ron Lauder paid John Bolton's PAC $1.2 million to conduct anti-Muslim messaging, basically scaring Republican voters about Muslims and trumping up support for Trump's Muslim ban. Again, I think this is another piece of Israeli influence. And now who is Trump's key national security advisor? John Bolton. He was basically propelled there by figures like Ron Lauder to turn up the heat on Iran. And now finally, we have the Iran Study Group. The Iran Study Group is run by a little known figure named Brian Hook. And it basically is a kind of Israeli influenced intelligence arm embedded in the Trump administration, exactly as the Office for Special Plans, which was a nest of neocons embedded in the Bush administration, was to make the case for war with Iran. And they're stovepiping bogus intelligence about Iranian missile capacity, Hezbollah capacity, straight to the White House desk around the, you know, State Department and Pentagon professionals, exactly as the Office for Special Plans did in the Bush administration when they were making the case that Saddam Hussein was somehow connected to Al-Qaeda and had weapons of mass destruction. Now, who ran the Office for Special Plans? It was Douglas Feith. Douglas Feith, who is investigated by the FBI in the 1980s for supplying classified information to the State of Israel. This is someone who is deeply involved with the Netanyahu operation. Now, who is working directly under Brian Hook, who is the director of the Iran Study Group? Douglas Feith's son, David Feith.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
And this is amazing. He's been installed in the State Department without anyone noticing.
I didn't know that, and I follow these issues.
Yeah, so there are just so many connections, and I'm sure that people listening to this are, you know, kind of getting a headache listening to me lay out these connections. But the reason I'm doing it is just to demonstrate the preponderance of Israeli influence and specifically Likud influence on this administration.
That's the voice of Max Blumenthal. Max is a journalist and best-selling author. His latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project, the co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. Max, also I want to remind people that Mike Flynn, who was the national security advisor before Bolton and before McMaster, he was fired after it was clear that that he had lied to the FBI. But what had he actually lied about? On December 22nd, he called the Russian ambassador. That was between the November election and January 20th when Trump took office. So he called the Russian ambassador on December 22nd, 2016. And he didn't faithfully, truthfully report when he was interviewed by the FBI exactly what he said to the Russian ambassador. So the American mainstream media like the Washington Post or CNN or MSNBC say, see, Mike Flynn was collaborating with the Russians. But what he was doing was calling the Russians and asking them to stop or prevent or vote no on a resolution that condemned the Israeli government's illegal settlements in the West Bank, something that the Obama administration at the Security Council had signaled it would abstain on, meaning it would be passed by the UN. So Mike Flynn, having talked to Jared Kushner, who was undoubtedly also in touch with the Israeli political forces here and in Israel, they said, please, Russia, don't vote no. Please vote no on Israel. And the Russians waited a day and got back and said, no, we're going to vote yes, and we're not going to slow this thing down. And that was presented in the American media as Russian collusion or collusion between Trump and Russia.
Right. I mean, actually, Netanyahu demanded that Jared Kushner, the presidential son-in-law whose family has been heavily involved with Netanyahu. I mean, Netanyahu would stay over at the Kushner family home when he was visiting New York. He asked Jared Kushner to order Michael Flynn to call Sergei Kislyak, the UN ambassador, and make that appeal. This was before Trump was president, so Obama was still president. They were going to do their little symbolic move against Israel at the UN and abstain on a vote condemning Israel for expanding settlements. And so this was a revelation, I think the first major revelation, that Russiagate was really Israelgate, but it was sold in the media as some kind of act of collusion between Michael Flynn and Sergei Kislyak. I mean, beyond that, you have George Papadopoulos, who we're told, and I don't buy this, but we're told that the whole Russiagate investigation was triggered by George Papadopoulos's involvement with supposed Russian agents. The reality is that George Papadopoulos and most of his work was focused on Israel and in Israel and on behalf of Israel. And that, in fact, George Papadopoulos's wife has said that she always believed he was an Israeli agent before George Papadopoulos, the coffee boy of the Trump 2016 campaign, was involved with Trump. He was at the Hudson Institute, which is a very pro-Israel, I would say pro-Likud think tank in Washington. And at the Hudson Institute, George Papadopoulos produced a paper alongside several Israeli operatives or pro-Israel operatives in Hebrew on behalf of the Israeli Energy Ministry, outlining potential for Israel's noble gas to speculate for gas in the Mediterranean. So he was doing work on behalf of the Israeli government, and we still don't know how or whether he's involved with any Russian government officials. Again, you look at Russiagate, and the deeper you look, it looks like Israelgate.
Yeah, Max Blumenthal is our guest. You know, the Trump administration did engage in a very sophisticated social media and Facebook operation. I'm looking at the NewYorkBooks.com website, NYBooks.com article. It came out, you know, a while ago. But what they did, what the Trump administration did, was very effective. And it's along the lines of what the Israeli side group was suggesting. In other words, in terms of voter manipulation, which doesn't mean it was only Trump who did it. But the Clinton administration focused more on TV advertising. Trump didn't really have to do that because he was getting so much free advertising from MSNBC and CNN and the others. So he focused on Facebook. I want to read to you real quick, Max, what this article says about how the Trump Facebook campaign functioned. We had three major voter suppression operations underway, a senior campaign official told Bloomberg's Green and Eisenberg. One targeted idealistic white liberals, primarily Bernie Sanders supporters. Another was aimed at young women, hence the procession of women who claimed to have been sexually assaulted by Bill Clinton and harassed by the candidate herself. And a third went after African Americans in urban centers where Democrats traditionally have a high voter turnout. One dark post featured a South Park-like animation narrated by Hillary Clinton using her 1996 remarks about President Bill Clinton's anti-crime initiative, in which she called young black men, quote, super predators who had to be brought to, quote, heel. We've modeled this, the unnamed senior campaign official, that's a Trump official, told Green and Eisenberg. It will dramatically affect her ability to turn these people out. In other words, a highly sophisticated targeting campaign directed towards people knowing what their preferences are. Cambridge Analytica used the same tools. These really can have an impact on elections, and far, far different from what, as you mentioned, what the so-called Internet Research Agency, the St. Petersburg Troll Farm, actually was doing in terms of efficacy.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds exactly like what Russia is accused of doing, which has not really been confirmed, which is sowing divisions and trying to pit different interest groups against the establishment in order to fragment American society and tear at the social fabric. And it was a very wise strategy for the Trump campaign. Basically, what he was doing was targeting the key interest groups of the Democratic Party base and seeking to depress their enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton. This played out also in Trump's rhetoric and his appearances. He did an appearance before an African-American group and said, what do you have to lose? Take a chance on me. The Democrats have already made life hell for you and your cities are already ruined. And his strategy was, you know, if I can get 2% less African-Americans to turn out for Hillary Clinton, I win. After the Orlando massacre by Omar Mateen, who swore loyalty to ISIS and shot up a gay-themed nightclub in Orlando, Donald Trump gave a speech targeting LGBT voters, and he actually used the phrase LGBTQ reading off a teleprompter with this strange smirk on his face. And I've never heard a Republican candidate use that phrase before. I mean, any Republican candidate. And it was the same thinking that the gay community typically votes for Democrats and Hillary Clinton. They have a lot of enthusiasm. If I can reduce their enthusiasm by pledging to protect them from Islamic extremism, then what's the harm in trying? And so that really was also reflected in his social media, his campaign's social media strategy. And I think it was pretty effective if you actually compare the turnout among minority groups for Barack Obama versus Hillary Clinton. But there was also an organic problem with Hillary Clinton. She actually did call African-American males super predators.
Exactly. Both things are true. Just as we close out here, Max Blumenthal, on the third election debate, the Trump social media Facebook team did 175,000 variations, tweaks, A-B tests of different ads with targeted advertising. That was the Trump administration. It wasn't the Russians. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from Washington by Max Blumenthal. Max is a journalist, best-selling author, whose latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and the co-host of the podcast, Moderate Rebels. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series. It happens every Tuesday, called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined, as we are every Tuesday, from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Uber, Lyft, the app driving companies, they've changed the face of the taxi business, but it turns out that more and more people are being driven into complete immiseration, Daniel. Another Uber driver commits suicide, the seventh within this year in New York City. Anyway, it's pretty amazing.
It's incredible, really, and it's pretty horrific. I think the point, you know, one of the most important things is this is not the first time this has happened. You know, as you mentioned, this has happened seven times before. And really what we're seeing is a taxi industry, where people, you know, work hard and long hours, but can make ends meet and, pay their bills, support their families, et cetera. And it's, of course, an industry that's in high demand in New York. A lot of people, tourists and such, need access to these taxis. Uber's come in and completely disrupted that industry, completely shattered it, which has resulted in taxi drivers who before enjoyed kind of a decent standard of living. They're forced into extreme debt, first of all, because the medallions of which they need to operate as taxi services to be regulated are essentially worthless, because the city has decided to just kind of throw up its hands and allow Uber to allow its drivers to operate without medallions. So these medallions are incredibly expensive. Taxi drivers have gone into debt to obtain them, and now they're worthless, right? They don't need them anymore, and the taxi industry is shrinking as it's being swallowed up by Uber. So many of them are forced to work for Uber, which means that there's this huge influx of labor into Uber, which, of course, Uber loves, because it allows them to offer extremely low wages to really undercut the drivers there and to offer much less than they normally would have made as taxi drivers. And so what that results in is this kind of race to the bottom, drivers working insanely long hours, exhausting hours, 16 hours a day sometimes, and it grinds down on you. And when you don't see a future, when you don't see an opportunity to get out of it, when you don't see a light at the end of the tunnel, suicide becomes a possibility for some of these people that have lost hope and have killed themselves. And so, you know, people like to talk about, you know, the technology industry as this sort of disrupting and opening up new markets and new opportunities. Uber loves to bill itself as some kind of job creator, giving people the opportunity to make a little money on the side. And you notice they always say it's making it on the side, because no one can have a full-time regular job as an Uber driver. It's always like a side gig. And the end result is people die. You know, that this is serious. It's not just disrupting an economy, which is such a euphemism. It is people being forced to work more than they can humanly do so, and to kill themselves in certain circumstances when they become so despondent and desperate. It's incredibly brutal.
You know, this is something really that I think we should all be focusing on as Americans. It's the last couple of sentences that Daniel just said, and that is that it's impossible to have one of these jobs and to make a living. It's just simply impossible. It's impossible even to reach the federal poverty level as a driver for the likes of Uber and Lyft. Now imagine how desperate people must be to work 20-hour days, still live in poverty, and then see the only alternative as suicide. That's just not acceptable. It's not acceptable for the wealthiest country in the world, an economy where we are at better than full employment. Economists say that full employment is 5%, because normally at any given time, 5% of people will be in between jobs or seeking better jobs or whatever. We have an unemployment rate now of 3.7%. Nobody should be living under the poverty level. Nobody should be considering suicide as the only alternative to their economic problems. But that's exactly what the problem is in this economy. It's a fake kind of economic success. It's a fake economic expansion. It's a fake low unemployment number.
Exactly. I mean, if you think about it, if you drive Uber for a single ride in a month, and make, I don't know, $20 or something off of it, according to federal statistics, you are employed. And therefore, you do not go towards that unemployment rate. But of course, no one can live off of that. You know, this speaks to what's called the gig economy, which is this model that's being created by tech companies like Uber, Lyft, TaskRabbit is another one, where people, it's kind of like piecemeal work was in the 1800s, which essentially means you get paid per job, paid per item produced. So you get paid per ride, you get paid per task completed, and it's an incredibly immiserating way of doing work. It creates tremendous poverty, which is, of course, why companies like Amazon, Uber, Lyft, and the rest of them are so profitable and so successful that they've been able to sidestep and skirt all sorts of different employment laws and employment regulations, which protect workers, which allow them some degree of protection and control in this economy. And they completely sidestepped it so that, you know, Uber argues that its drivers are not employees. It's adamant about that. They're not employees. They're contractors at best, which is absurd. Of course, they're employees. They produce all the wealth that Uber needs. If they all stopped working for Uber, Uber would go belly up. They're absolutely employees. But because they can make that argument and because essentially, you know, the regulators and state powers don't do anything about it, don't step in, what you see is this incredible push down in wages. And that's what you're seeing more and more now, where this is becoming kind of the new normal of how work is. And it's been long enough that I don't think very many people are alive that remember how it was during the Industrial Revolution. But this was how it worked, where people were paid, you know, a tiny couple of pennies or less for every piece of, you know, sheet metal pressed or every bolt put into place. And they would have to do hundreds and then thousands in a week just to make enough money to live. And they would just count up the little bolts and say, okay, well, here's your couple of coins that you get for that. And, you know, it was a horrible way to live. And there was a huge fight back and unionization and the, you know, the whole labor struggle is a different conversation for a different day. But we're seeing them roll back to that age where it's not bolts anymore, but it's rides or it's tasks or it's widgets pushed out in an Amazon factory that you get paid off of. And it's an incredibly brutal way of organizing labor.
Daniel's right. Daniel Sankey is our guest. Daniel's right about the way it was in the Industrial Revolution. But I have to say, just as a minor amendment, Daniel, and it's very minor, this system of piecework hasn't really fully ended. It's changed. When I first started working, I worked as a clothing worker. The minimum wage at that time was $1.85 an hour. That was in 1971. And I went into I was a trimmer in a clothing factory. And most of the women who were in there working, and that was about 3/4 of the workforce, a fairly large factory that ultimately went overseas, went somewhere in Asia. Those women were paid by piecework. So you saw them rushing constantly, each piece of each pocket that they sewed, each little piece of a cuff for a slack. Each piece was their pay. So if they were very, very, very fast, they were paid poorly. And if they were pretty slow, which of course the younger, newer workers were, less skilled, they paid almost nothing and really less than minimum wage. And so in some ways, as the unions have weakened over the last 40 years, this piecework, which was, you know, it was kind of something in textile and some of the other industries, and I'm talking in this case about textile, that's becoming sort of the commonplace now, also known as the race to the bottom. Instead of a guaranteed wage, which of course is already exploitative, because the reason an employer hires a worker is you're going to produce more value than you've been paid in wages. Otherwise, there's no profit. I mean, that's where profit comes from. But in the case of piecework, if you fall behind, it's your problem. Now, there's another part to this, which is I want to go back to since we're talking about taxis, which is the medallions. The medallions, there's 13,587 medallions in New York City. What is a medallion? A medallion is basically part of the taxi and limousine commission licensing scheme so that someone buys a medallion, which means they have the right to put a yellow taxi on the road. That doesn't mean they have to drive the yellow taxi. That just means they have the authority to put that taxi on the road. The people who really drive the taxis are mainly, at this point, not medallion owners. The medallions are auctioned off and rich people and speculators like Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's lawyer. He had 200 of them. They buy these medallions at an auction. That means they can put 200 yellow taxis on the road. And then they divide the shift into two 12-hour shifts. One person takes the cab out at 5 in the morning and brings it to the next driver at 5 in the afternoon. So the cab is constantly running. Who pays for the gas for the cab? That would be the cab driver. Who pays the tolls? That would be the cab driver. In New York City, when you go from borough to borough, you're paying tolls. If you have breakdowns frequently, that's also down to the driver. And on top of that, the driver has to pay the medallion owner maybe $150 or $170 to take the taxi out for the day. So you might work as a taxi driver 5 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours, and you're not back to zero yet. That's what we're talking about with this kind of licensing. And then you have Uber and Lyft come in that can undercut the fares that you receive as a taxi driver. And so people are going to take Uber instead of the taxi. That's why this is happening. That's these cascading a set of events whereby some people, it's not just people are suffering. Some people are making lots and lots of money off of this system.
Absolutely. I think one of the things we need to point out is a lot of times we like to talk up, or I should say, you know, mainstream media likes to talk up people like Cohen or, you know, Bezos or Uber as, you know, they accumulate this in tremendous wealth because of their innovation or their skill. But what we can see is, you know, as you go through the kind of how the taxi medallion schema works, people accumulate this great wealth because other people have to live in poverty. You know, I don't want to give the impression that being a taxi driver was some sort of well-paid utopia. It certainly wasn't, as obviously your description points out. But it was better than working as an Uber driver, where an Uber driver is pushing them down even more. And you can see this explosive growth of Uber, which is now this massive, you know, private company. The point is, though, that these people aren't making this money because they're brilliant or they're clever or they're talented and hardworking. They're making it because other people are in poverty, which is the only way Jeff Bezos can make however many thousands of dollars a second he makes, is because someone else is making much, much less. And that's what we need to start having a conversation about, is as a society, does it make sense that people gain incredible wealth simply at the expense of others, not because of their own talent and abilities, which is what we're seeing with Uber? That needs to be a major question that we as a society need to answer. And it's a moral question. It's a political question. That doesn't make sense that wealth be distributed this way. Does it make sense that the thousands of Uber drivers that crisscross New York, that are working 16-hour days, sweating it out, exhausted in a cab, go into such a poverty that they need to kill themselves, whereas the, you know, executive board of Uber is obviously millionaires. Does that make sense? And, you know, I think the clear answer is it doesn't. So we need to start asking ourselves, what do we do with that wealth and how do we distribute it in a way that fosters human life, that fosters the type of world we want to live in, where people are able to feed themselves and their families and live in relative comfort? And that's a very important question that needs to be answered.
One more thing before we leave this issue. And I'm glad we're taking the time to deal with it. We all talk about Uber. We rely on Uber or Lyft or taxis, especially in urban environments where it's almost impossible to park, where we're getting, you know, speeding tickets with these photo enforcement, where you're getting a $100, $200 fine because they've stuck a 25-mile-per-hour sign in a place that people routinely drive 35 or 40 just to be able to make tons of money. Like there's this one box, John, down on K Street going into Georgetown. Last year, mm-hmm. that box accumulated $22 million in fines, just that one box. So people are loath to keep driving if they can avoid it. So it becomes cheaper to use Uber or to Lyft or occasionally taxis. But then again, it presents to us a picture of what's happening to the American working class and the American economy. And I want to go back to the New York City taxi situation one last time, because in the 1970s and in the 1960s and 50s and 40s, up until the late 1970s, there was a taxi workers union in New York City that had collective bargaining agreements for the people who were driving on garage-based medallion cabs, meaning, and I did that job as well, meaning you went to a garage like the 57th Street Garage on the West Side and you shape up, meaning you get there at 4:30 or 5 in the morning. You wait till a cab comes in. You're in line with other people. when it's your turn, you get that driver coming in from the night shift, parks, you take that car, you gas up, and you went out. Now, back then, there was no, you didn't have to lease the cab. You didn't have to pay for repairs. You didn't have to pay gas. You got 50%, or if you were an experienced driver, 53% of whatever the meter was. So you actually could make a decent living as a cab driver in New York City because there was a union. And you also had, back then, and this was the case when I was driving in New York, you had a two-week vacation paid for. No taxi driver gets that at all. Healthcare benefits. There was all kinds of things associated with normal employment that once the union was broken and this lease for hire system, whereby everybody became an independent contractor rather than an employee, that's when this all started to go down, but it's only accelerated as it goes down. And that's why we have the seventh suicide right now in New York City. Anyway, Daniel, before we go on, let's have you have the last word here on this issue.
Absolutely. I think the talk about unions is incredibly important. I think those of us that, you know, didn't work during that time period that you mentioned, Brian, don't realize how good things actually could be for those workers that were unionized. And back in the 70s, relative to now, unions were much, much stronger, were much more significant in power. So what we need to realize now as the union force in the unionized workforce in the United States shrinks, and it's such a tiny percentage now, I think less than 10% workers are in unions.
6% in private sector and about 30% in the public sector.
Okay, so 6% in private sector, which is nothing. How much that immiserates working people, how much that takes away all these little things. You describe, you know, being a taxi driver in the 70s compared to now. I mean, the 70s would sound like some kind of paradise where they don't have to pay all these extra fees and get nickel and dime and actually have a significant chunk of the meter in their pockets as opposed to going into whoever owns the medallion or all the toll booths or whatever. That sort of world can happen. And that wasn't some kind of utopia in the 70s. I mean, we were a major capitalist power at that point. We were a for-profit country. There was nothing utopian about it. And yet, because unions were strong, because they had those bargaining rights, they demanded that their workers be taken seriously and be given, you know, jobs with dignity. And that's what we need now. So as we see this tiny percentage of the workforce being de-unionized, and, you know, we had the recent Janus pass through the Supreme Court, so now that further weakens unions, we can expect to see more of this, which is why organized labor united together is the best, the most effective way to create jobs with dignity so that you can have a single job and pay for your family so you don't need to have some kind of side gig, three jobs, four jobs, all these multi-income households while everyone's scrambling to make it. We can actually have one job that you go to work, you do your thing, you come home, and then your life can belong to you rather than belong to Uber or whoever you're doing side gigs for. This sort of world is possible. It's something we've had before. It's certainly something we can have again, and it's a great place to start.
And with Brett Kavanaugh on the court, it's going to be harder for labor.
It sure is.
Kavanaugh, and this is one of the reasons, even though we have focused naturally on the issue of Kavanaugh's alleged assault against Dr. Christine Blasey Ford and his other untruths that he told during the congressional testimony, the Democrats made very little out of the fact that Kavanaugh was groomed by the Federalist Society to be this judge, to be the Supreme Court judge. Same with Gorsuch. And the reason is they have 100% or maybe 100% is wrong, probably 97% voting against workers and for bosses.
That's right.
I mean, and that's the real agenda of the Federalist Society, the so-called constitutionalist, the originalist, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
The real thing is they want private property owning businesses, profit maximizing businesses, to have all the rights and to work, and workers to have no, not only no rights, but no recourse to the courts. That's who Judge Kavanaugh is. He is the enemy of labor. He is the enemy of working people. And you can see it based on his judicial decisions during his tenure on the D.C. Court of Appeals.
That's a really important point to make, because what the Federalists realize is if they want this big rollback of progressive reforms that we've won, such as abortion rights or such as protection for immigrants or protections for LGBTQ people, that really at the heart of it is the economic. And if they can push down workers, if they can drive down their wages and further immiserate them and disempower them so that they don't have a voice in the court system, it makes it that much easier to start rolling back all those rules. I mean, I think of, you know, access to abortion. There's all these different states that technically abortion's legal, but they made the barrier so incredibly high to open a clinic or to afford an abortion that no one can have one anyway. So it's effectively illegal. It's effectively something you can't use. And so that's how they're going to go after those things. If they can weaken workers, if they can disempower them, then they can also roll back these progressive reforms that workers have acquired over the years. And that's the agenda. That's essentially what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm looking at the Huffington Post from, I think this is an article back in August. I want to read a couple of sentences to you. When a New York manufacturer created a new spinoff company to avoid bargaining with unionized workers, in other words, just to create a shell company, federal regulators and a panel of appellate judges said the manufacturer broke the law and violated its employees' rights. There was, however, one judge who dissented in the appeals decision and sided with the employer. Brett Kavanaugh, President Donald Trump's nominee to replace Justice Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court, was that judge. That's who Kavanaugh is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is an obvious case. The company is unionized. They don't want to have any more dealings with unionized workers. They create a scam company, a shell company. Say, well, we have a new company now, so we're no longer obligated under the contract, the collective bargaining contract. And all the judges, with the exception of Brett Kavanaugh, said, no, that's illegal.
Right.
That's who Brett Kavanaugh is. By the way, last little piece of trivia, which I only learned this morning, but I'm sure John, you know it, or Daniel knows it, or somebody knows it. I think it was about 10 years ago, the United Auto Workers was organizing a Trump casino in Atlantic City. And it was Kavanaugh in the circuit court who ruled against the union and on behalf of the Trump casino to get rid of the collective bargaining. It was an attempt to unionize the Trump casino by UAW. And the NLRB moved to support the workers' right to organize it. In a decision by the D.C. Court of Appeals, with Kavanaugh writing the decision, the UAW was banished.
I did not know that.
Yeah, that's Brett Kavanaugh.
That's Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, and you can tell Trump remembered that. You know, he knew who to pay back when the time came because he knew what type of person this was. And it's so disingenuous. I mean, we have this, you know, capitalist ideology which talks about freedom and liberty to kind of work where you want to work and do what you want to do. And yet when workers organize, when they try to come together and demand something as a fighting force, well, this is just, you know, the heart of anarchy and un-Americanism, and it needs to be crushed immediately. And it needs to be, people have the right to talk together. People have the right to unionize. People have the right to demand things as a group. It's the most democratic thing in the world that people should come together and with a common cause and a common goal and unite to fight for it. That's, you know, the very basis of democracy. And yet when corporations do it, when they work together to fix prices or when they work together to have favorable, you know, business relationships, that's or to lobby certain politicians, this is perfectly acceptable. But if workers do the same thing, well, this is something that becomes literally outlawed. I mean, it wasn't so long ago that organizing in a union was a crime where you could go to jail for joining a union or for trying to start a union. Can you imagine that? Going around talking to people, talking about unionizing, and you're imprisoned? You know, they would call out cops who would bust up unions and literally beat people in the streets and sometimes kill them because they were trying to unionize. This is the type of world that Brett Kavanaugh wants us to roll back to, a world where workers have no right whatsoever but to be exploited to the maximum so that the bosses, the Jeff Bezoses of the world, can profit as much as possible.
I said that was going to be my last piece of trivia, but I want to go one step further. I can't help myself here. At the time or around the time that Brett Kavanaugh was ruling against the United Auto Workers' right to unionize the Trump casino at Atlantic City, around that same time, Donald Trump, his businesses were in trouble, and they couldn't really get loans from American banks. So they got loans from Deutsche Bank.
That's right.
They got a lot of loans from Deutsche Bank.
Hundreds of millions of dollars.
Okay, so again, let's close this circle. Brett Kavanaugh is now the Supreme Court Justice replacing who? Anthony Kennedy. What's Anthony Kennedy's relationship with Deutsche Bank? Deutsche Bank's Anthony Kennedy's son, Justin, was in charge of Deutsche Bank's real estate capital markets division. at the time, Donald Trump was getting these hundreds of millions of dollars of loan.
What a small world.
So Trump somehow convinces Kennedy to resign. And Kennedy says, yeah, I'll resign, but I want my clerk, Brett Kavanaugh, to be the nominee. And Trump says, no problem. He's the guy who helped me at the Trump casino make sure United Auto Workers didn't do it.
You can't make this up.
You can't make it up. And also, I don't know if you remember this other piece of trivia. I think it was at his first or maybe second State of the Union address when Trump walked into the hall, he stopped and said hello to Judge Kennedy and said, say hello to your son for me.
Oh,
but of course, that's Justin from Deutsche Bank bailing out Donald Trump, then bankrupt real estate businesses and casinos. Anyway, it's just all these are unconnected. We don't have to draw a line to connect all those dots unless you want to.
I mean, what I'm reminded of is, you know, if you remember back in the medieval ages, you'd have all these royal ruling families that would form alliances with one another by marrying one another's children to them. And then they would create these networks of power where, you know, Spain would be in favor with France because they have shared bloodlines and et cetera, et cetera. And this is a very normal thing and commonplace. You know, and we look back at the governments, the medieval ages, and kind of say, ooh, that was a, you know, brutal time to live. It's a good thing we don't have kings and queens like that. And yet, what's the difference, right? You know, we have people's sons that are over in charge of entities that are providing loans to fathers and friends of fathers so that they could then appoint said fathers or their friends to positions of power so that they can then, you know, maybe get a cousin, you know, to some sort of courtship or legal profession. I mean, it all reminds me of, you know, sort of this medieval ages, these networks of families that control and dominate things. And yet, you know, here we are in the U.S. where the propaganda is that, oh, no, we're free. We don't have kings. We don't have dukes and we're not, you know, filled with nobility.
We just have plutocrats. So instead of an autocracy, we have a plutocracy, the rule of, by, and for wealth. Anyway, Daniel, we spent so much time on one or two stories, which we said we wouldn't, but we did again. Let's talk in our last 2.5 minutes about the Toys R Us workers, poor workers, again, through no fault of their own, losing their jobs.
Yeah, this story actually was at least somewhat heartening amidst all these, you know, depressing stories about workers losing their rights. And it talked about how Toys R Us workers were laid off without severance. As you know, Toys R Us went bankrupt and it's falling apart. And right now they're organizing and fighting against the private equity firm which purchased Toys R Us. And private equity firm's job is basically to take advantage of companies that are going out of business and undercutting them and forcing them to accept really low prices so that the private equity firm can kind of sell the company off piece by piece and try to make a profit. It's a pretty brutal form of profit making. And so right now the workers are organizing, and they're organizing on the pensions that invest with these private equity firms, the workers' pensions, and pressuring the pensions to divest from private equity firms that are not behaving in a way that's popular to the workers. And actually, it was effective enough to make a private equity firm put aside $20 million for these workers to be earmarked to benefit them. And it's not totally clear exactly how it's going to benefit them, and I'm sure they'll try to fight about it at some point or maybe go to court over it. But the point being is that these giants are being pressured to do that so that these poor workers, by no fault of their own, who also work long hours for terrible pay, can get some kind of severance, some kind of safety net from these private equity firms. And more, the article goes on to say, is they're starting to see this, where these pension funds are being used by the workers to pressure these private equity firms by threatening them with divestment. It's actually pretty exciting to see them kind of pool their economic strength that way and pressure these companies in a way that's positive. So it was a big win for Toys R Us workers. It's, you know, $20 million is a lot of money, but it's certainly not nearly enough. It's certainly much less than they deserve, but it is a step in the right direction. And hopefully it kind of galvanizes workers everywhere to take advantage of these pension funds and try to exert pressure on some of these companies.
That's Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst who joins us here at Loud and Clear every Tuesday in a segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.